Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'm going to be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we delve into the world of business and politics here in Ireland and around the world. Coming up on today's show, the seven most valuable companies are not only linked by their financial success, they're linked by artificial intelligence. And today we'll be looking at the Magnificent Seven as they're known. Who are they? How much are they valued at? And are they unstoppable in terms of their economic success? And at the other end of all that technology is, of course, in our own hands. So today we'll touch on a very pressing topic, which has been highlighted by Professor John Hythe in his new book. It's called The Anxious Generation. He argues that smartphones and social media are at the core of a mental health crisis that is affecting young people. And he calls for urgent action to be taken. So we're going to speak to a neurotherapist about that issue later on in the show. And finally, author Daniel Susskind, who has just published a magnificent history of economic growth. It's called Growth, The Reckoning. He'll be joining me later on to discuss why we simply cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. I'm looking forward to that discussion later. And if you want to get in contact with us, you can do so at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Now,
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
We've started a new slot on this show. It's called Techscape, and we're going to be looking at some of the tech issues and indeed the opportunities that face business and society in general. And it's all thanks to PwC. Today, we're going to be talking about AI. Take a quick listen to this. That was, of course, the iconic music from the 1960s when Western, the Magnificent Seven, and indeed turning to the stock exchange, the Magnificent Seven, as they're known, are the shining light of the US stock market, providing a whopping 71% return for investors in the S&P 500. The other 493 companies only offered a 6% return. Well, that was last year. Will 2024 be a blockbuster year, or will the Magnificent Seven find some bumps on the road? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Carl Schmieders, who's Professor of Finance International at the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. Carl, you're very welcome to Taking Stock here on News Talk.
Thank you very much for having me, Mandy. It's a delight to be on your show.
Now, these companies, obviously hugely successful, and they're linked by that financial success, but they're also linked by something else, artificial intelligence. Can you take us through who the companies are and what makes them so successful?
The term Magnificent Seven actually was only coined last year by a Bank of America analyst, Michael Hartnett. And he related, because there were seven, he related it to the movie from the 1960s. These seven companies are Microsoft, Apple, Nvidia, the chip manufacturer, Alphabet, that's the parent company of Google, Amazon, Meta, formerly known as Facebook, and Tesla. Now, having said this, these seven companies were very successful in 2023. And so then these experts in finance always like to do some storytelling. Mm-hmm. Humans like to detect pattern, even when no pattern exists. So, and then they came up with this phrase. Previously, the popular phrase, which some of you may have heard, is FANG. Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google. So while here I'm delighted to look at some of the fundamentals with you, Mandy, let's keep in mind that there's also always a lot of hot air in markets.
We won't let hot air stop us from discussing it all anyway. Now, a lot of us will be very familiar with lots of those company names, but one that I'd like to kind of delve into a bit more is NVIDIA. You mentioned that they're chip manufacturers. Maybe tell us a little bit about their success in 2023 and how prolific it actually was.
We first have to look at sort of some data. By sort of late 2023, these seven companies were in the top 10 worldwide of companies by company value. Apple came above $3 trillion Tesla was the smallest by $760 billion, which was still much, much more than comparable companies in Europe. All of them are in the tech sphere, and that's why they got grouped together. Nvidia, of course, is a chip manufacturer that is, and these chips are very fast and they are critical in for AI, for artificial intelligence. And so that's, for example, why that stock went up a lot. Then we have companies such as Microsoft or Meta that want to use AI in their products or are already using it, similarly for Google. And so on this whole AI tech wave, these companies had, as you mentioned in your introduction, tremendous advances in their stock prices. Mm. And what now really made people scratch their head is that if we look at the NASDAQ 100, the top 100 technology stocks in the United States, these seven are almost 40% of the total market value. Mm. On the S&P 500, it's more than 30%. Now, what that means for us as investors, if you have an ETF or a market index fund on the NASDAQ 100 or on the S&P 500, and we think we are well diversified. No, we're not well diversified anymore if 30 or 40% of our funds is in only seven stocks. Mm. So for all of us, this is something we have to keep in the back of our mind.
Mm. That's a really interesting point. So diversification, something that people should look out for. Maybe one of the other brands that we'd all be familiar with is Tesla Motors. And we've seen them going through their own difficulties and their talisman, Elon Musk, never far from the headlines. Tell us what happened there over the last couple of months and what you expect to happen in the future, because the EV market has been very disappointing.
I'm glad you're asking this, Mandy. So this now gets me back to my criticism of the Magnificent Seven. While there are some similarities, they are also very different companies working in different markets. So Tesla was in the top 10 late last year, but now they've fallen out of the top 10. And if you look at just the performance of the of these Magnificent Seven, year to date, until last night, I looked at some data. Tesla is actually the worst or second worst performer in the NASDAQ 100, while on the other hand, Nvidia is number one. Now, what's happening with Tesla? The EV market, as you correctly pointed out, has been rather disappointing. First, we see a little bit of sustainability fatigue among customers. Mm. And in addition, Tesla has greatly benefited from subsidies for EVs. And then when a car country such as Germany ends its subsidies for EVs, that's bad for the entire market. So we see a little bit of a consolidation in that market in the Western world. In addition, Tesla is now facing increased competition, in particular in China. Competitors such as BYD, Build Your Dreams, has really eaten up in their markets. And so Tesla is in a very competitive market. And so they lost almost 40%. Since the end of 2023.
A real demonstration how things can change very quickly for a company even as successful as Tesla. Maybe turn to Amazon now for a second, Carl, if you could tell us about what's happening with them and their competition in the US in particular.
Yeah, so I think this is really an important point that you're making there. We really have to look at company by company and look at their competition. Now, Amazon has done quite well, almost a plus of 20% since the end of December. But we really have to look at their business. So you mentioned competition. They are very active in the cloud market. Mm. And the cloud market has grown tremendously in recent years. And Amazon still is with the Amazon Web Services, AWS, is the undisputed champion. So they have more than 30% of the market share Microsoft Azure is second with 24%, and Google Cloud Platform has only 11%. So Amazon and Microsoft are really ahead there. Of course, there are smaller players like Alibaba, Oracle, and IBM's, but so there, they are in a strong position. Now, as long as the cloud market continues to grow, they will be doing very well. Hmm. Once these markets mature, then it will be really sort of a real competition. What one company sells more, another one will then sell less. So for the time being, Amazon is doing very, very well there. Now, where they're not doing so well is in digital advertising. Now, digital advertising is a little bit more difficult to quantify the market shares because you have advertising in social media, in search engines, in videos. But Amazon is really a distant third there compared to Google with its search engine and Meta with the Facebook platform. Both of them have more than 25%, while Amazon is under 10%. So there, Amazon potentially could gain more, but there they have a very difficult situation. Mm. Now, I really like, Mandy, you emphasizing competition. And so here now I also want to say something where Tesla was lucky and where we see the intensity of the competition. 2 months ago, Apple canceled its long-term efforts to build an electric car. They just realized that they don't have the expertise to compete with Tesla. And so that just shows us when a company like Apple that more than 10 years invested in bringing an EV to market finally gave up. Mm. Yeah. So I think this is something we should not forget, the intense competition that these companies face every day.
Yeah, and just going back to the Apple decision there, and you mentioned a little bit earlier sustainability fatigue. Maybe, you know, it's a good business decision recognizing that there is a little bit of sustainability fatigue, that those subsidies are going, that there's not the same secondhand market in the EVs. They've just made a very good, albeit difficult, business decision to reverse engines, if you forgive the pun. Carl, can I just turn to a sort of wider issue when it comes to investing in these type of stocks? Like, are there other considerations factoring in, like energy supply, power from different countries and who can provide energy security to large companies like this now? Is that, you know, factoring in investors' decisions?
Yeah, so currently, of course, the energy is on everybody's mind, in particular here in Europe, because of the Ukraine war, we had sort of energy costs went through the roof in Western Europe. So it's clearly on everyone's mind. And there are now sort of increasing voices that are really concerned about the electricity consumption of the AI technology. I have the impression that this is appears to be a bit overblown. Mm. So that if you think about the amount of energy that's wasted on Bitcoin mining, and we already have a lot of energy eaten up by data centers. So yes, absolutely, there will be a strong growth in AI-related electricity consumption. No doubt about that. But I think in the bigger picture, we don't have to worry about it as much.
Yeah.
I think on a worldwide level, and maybe just sort of briefly mention this for those of your listeners who are interested in this, but it's really a topic for another day and another discussion. Clearly, the world, the globe as a whole, needs way more energy and electricity. Because as very populous countries such as India, China, and Indonesia develop a lot further and want to increase the well-being, the income per capita, they need more energy. And a lot of that energy comes from burning coal. And I think that problem is orders and orders of magnitude larger for humanity and the world than the AI demand.
Well, as you say, that's a much wider discussion, which hopefully we'll get to talk about on another occasion. But before I let you go, Carl, can I ask you what we should be looking out for in the months ahead? Is there anybody who might be entering the race that we haven't thought of now to see joining these big tech companies?
Yeah, so as you know by now, you all have heard that I'm not a big fan of these acronyms, and I'm sure there's another acronym just around the corner. What are the big themes? Clearly, the theme of AI will continue to dominate. As we see new ideas, new users, more and more companies train their own AI systems. So I think that as an overarching theme will continue to dominate. And so we should look at that space. And here now, if I may say so, a lot of course, the hype and the fancy terminology comes from the U.S. Now, let's look outside the U.S. There are fantastic winners out there. For example, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which by now has broken into the top 10 by companies by market cap worldwide. They saw an increase of more than 33% this year. And so they also benefiting from the AI hype. In the United Kingdom, there's Arm Holdings, which has seen a 43% increase in its stock prices here, despite a major setback yesterday. So I think we should look at the themes that are there. In Europe, again, I think in Europe, we are usually a little more modest than in the U.S., I think one of the great stories is happening in Denmark. Novo Nordisk is now the most valuable company in Europe. It's already number 13 in the worldwide ranking of companies by market capitalization. It's a Danish pharmaceutical company. And how did they get so valuable? What the heck happened? Oh, they have a drug, Vejovi, or I don't know how to pronounce it properly, which regulates our appetite. And this has been proven to be a super effective drug against obesity. Obesity is a very serious problem. More than 750 million people in the world have obesity. And obesity leads to a lot of serious issues, decreases life expectancy, increases global death rates. And so there we have a non-IT story.
Yeah. And something that is not unique to any country. It's a worldwide problem. Carl, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. You heard it there first, folks. There's some three top tips for you from Carl. Carl, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. That was Carl Schmathers, Professor of Finance at the International Institute for Management Development at Lausanne. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy.
You're listening to News Talk's Taking Stock. Up next, we'll be finding out the effect of all that technology on children's play patterns. Don't go anywhere. I want to talk about a book that I've come across recently. It's called The Anxious Generation, and it's a book by Professor Jonathan Haidt, and it makes an urgent argument that smartphones and social media are the root cause of an epidemic of mental health problems, which are particularly affecting young people. So I wanted to bring somebody in who would know this area really well, tell us if this is the case, and if so, what could be done about it. So I'm delighted to be joined now by Alwyn Moran, who's neurodevelopmental therapist and founder of Cogni Kids. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Alwyn, you're very welcome to studio, and thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this book by Professor Haidt contends that this curse, if you want to call it that, of smartphones in relation to children and how they're being used by children and by parents for their children is the same or can be compared to nutritional food. Or if we want to put a more extreme version on this, that it's like a Victorian practice of dosing babies with gin. And we'll look back in generations to come at what we're doing now and say, what on earth were they doing? Do you agree with that?
I do, and I've been very vocal about this for a long time. I'm kind of obsessed in this area for about 8 or 9 years. And definitely there is so much data out there now that is actually, and the problem is that, you know, when I started talking about this and started being very concerned about the use of it and the ages that children were given access to screen devices and smartphones, and the proliferation of it through our teenagers, the studies weren't being done then. And a lot of these studies are longitudinal studies. So we're now starting to see data. So this is studies that started, you know, back in 2012, 2013, 2014. So we're now starting to see that data being disseminated. And like, it's absolutely terrifying. Pre-pandemic numbers. Mm. This is an example of one number. Pre-pandemic numbers. Research was identifying that 68% of six-month-old babies were given access to a screened device.
Mm.
That is shocking in itself. So I absolutely, I love Jonathan Haidt. And, you know, I think that he is spot on. Mm. He really is.
So, look, this is a business show. We look at geopolitical issues and big business, and some would say that this is a mental health discussion or a health discussion or even a societal discussion. But specifically, he has spent 6 years looking at the area of statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly as you say there, what struck me about this is these statistics don't belong to the last 2 or 3 years. It's yeah. something that has been going on for decades. And it isn't just about the interaction between a child and a smartphone. It's also parents and their willingness, I suppose, to not just condone this behaviour, but also kind of use it as an antidote to child's behaviour. But before we get into all that, maybe yeah. just take us through some of the statistics that show how boys are being affected, how teenagers are being affected, and how they differentiate between boys and girls.
Yeah, well, the statistics show that actually girls are much more affected, particularly by social media, than boys are. There's a huge correlation between social media use between or among teenage girls and their mental health.
And why are girls more affected than boys?
It's a lot to do with their brain structure, the hormones. They've much more oxytocin, which is much more empathic. You know, we're much more connected than, say, boys, essentially. And, you know, girls kind of, like, we tend to flock together as such as well. So they're much more vulnerable.
Mm.
It's the same thing about body image, you know. Body image, now, I'm not saying it doesn't affect boys, but I'm saying that girls, statistically, we know the data, it shows that girls are much more affected and much more sensitive around their body image than boys are. So,
and I guess they're much more susceptible to the idea of perfectionism, especially when it comes to body image and things like that.
Absolutely. But they're also much more kind of, I suppose, like exposed to it because they're on social media an awful lot.
Are they on more than boys?
They are on more than boys. And they are much more exposed to filtered images. They don't understand. If you have a tween and they're looking through social media and they're looking through images and so on, a lot of them don't understand that actually they're filtered. Mm. They're not, you know, that's not a real image that you're seeing. Or the, you know, if you met that person in real life, there's a good possibility that that person doesn't actually look exactly as they look in the screen or, you know, what they're seeing. Mm. So there's so much kind of more vulnerability. And at this age as well, the tween age, there's brain shifts in their wiring around this age to wire our children to actually kind of pull away slightly from our parents and to be less influenced by what our parents, it's kind of, you know, I always say it's like when the kids start eye rolling at you, you know, you kind of, you know, they're at this phase where they're starting to pull away because they have to get their own sense of identity. But actually, if we look at the origins of where this brain wiring comes from, it's basically to enable them to become independent beings, to seek out their own people and their own tribe. And this is where they become extremely vulnerable then because, you know, they're so much more vulnerable to like a negative comment than a positive comment on if they post something they don't understand about, you know, don't share everything because they follow people who share everything. So they think that that's the norm.
One of the things for Professor Hyde in this book is that, look, we only ever have a conversation about one half of this problem, which is the smartphones, the social media. But what about the alternative? You know, so when we were younger, we messed about outdoors. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, a lot of that was dangerous. But that was the point, I guess. We were learning to live in a world where you had to build resistance. And just as you're saying,
absolutely,
just at a time when you're trying to carve out a little bit of independence for yourself, you're creating that resilience by doing exactly that. And your parents allowed you to do that. But he talks about a phone-based childhood being very different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always say, you know, like if you look at when you give a child a phone, what does it take away from them? So the two main things it takes away from them is movement and social connection, like in real life social connection. And when you understand the brain and you know what the brain needs in order to grow and develop and make good connections, the two things, like from day one, from the day the baby is born, the two things that the baby needs, social connection and movement. It helps wire in the brain. That movement, they're born with these primitive reflexes. They help to wire the arms and the legs and, you know, into the brain. So the brain, you know, we're born about a year before our brain is actually ready. And thankfully, because we wouldn't be able to birth children. But those primitive reflexes help to wire the body into the brain. So it's movement, and consistently movement is required for brain health. You talk to anybody who is dealing with children with, you know, ADD or ADHD or any issues, and they'll always prescribe, get outdoors, do some movement.
It's the fresh air as well, isn't it?
So it's not just the fresh air. It's like, what are you doing when you're outside? You're walking around, you know, you might be running up and down the mountain or by the sea or just even around in the park, things like that. You might be kicking a ball, but it's actually movement. It is the opposite left, right, that gives so much feedback to the brain that it actually, you know, it really helps to develop that brain.
We talked about the girls there and how they're more susceptible and more exposed. Let's just talk about young boys and teenage boys. How does their experience online and social media differ? And are they spending less time than girls online and on phones?
They spend time differently online. They're much more likely to be gaming online than girls are. Girls are much more likely to be on the social media side of things. Boys are much more likely to be on, you know, Roblox or Minecraft and World of War or whatever it's called. You know, that's kind of what the boys go for. Much more high adrenaline. They get very, very deeply immersed into it.
So they're more using it for distraction or they're not using it for interaction or networking in the same way that girls are.
No, not at all. And, you know, they'll often say, yeah, but I'm playing with my friends online. But actually, lovely, I've seen an interview recently with Professor Jonathan there, and he was saying, actually, if you think about it, you know, kind of saying in the 80s, it used to be, you know, you'd call around to somebody's house, five or six of you, and you'd play a video game, the five or six of you, and you might have pizza, but it was like a social thing where you were all together in the one room and they were all playing, you know, kind of like, I don't know, the Atari or something like that. So now, he said, it's very sad because now you have to be in your own room. You have to be away from everybody else, and you're actually gaming on your own, even though you might be talking and interacting with somebody else or, you know, that online gaming, you're actually not connecting in the physical, in the real world.
Yeah. And one of the things that struck me about that particular point is that even the names of social media things have changed. So now we refer to platforms, and it gives a sense that the platforms are there and there's some sort of performance required, where it used to be social networks and it was it was designed to connect people. There's very much that notion that you're performing, you're on it to show that your life is good, you're having a good time. And that's what children are doing, but they don't have maybe the resilience of our generation or understanding to know that that's not actually real life.
No, they really don't. They don't have that worldly wise experience. And that's something that's actually really, you know, kind of brought to the fore actually was the age of consent. So the age of consent is 13. And, you know, there's a big push for that to be moved to 16. Mm. Unless you have parental consent for younger, so say 13 or 14. And this is where we're talking about you need to have the businesses behind these social platforms. They have to take some kind of responsibility. You know, they have designed everything to be highly addictive.
Mm.
Absolutely. They you know, hired developmental psychologists to figure out how to keep people on their platform longer. And that's where the like button came from, the retweet, you know, and all of these reward systems. So they do reward your brain. You get this little hit of dopamine and then you want to go back and check again and check again. So they have to have some kind of responsibility in terms of the age that children are allowed onto these platforms.
So just, okay, so let's look at the other side of this whole discussion now and try and talk about solutions or because I feel sorry for parents,
yeah,
who must be afraid themselves of what they're doing. Mm. And they must be fearful of what the consequences are, but they're still trapped in a peer pressure from their children almost, and they don't want to have their child be an outlier or outside of their peer group, so it's difficult for them. So let's look at solutions for a second. On this side of the equation where parents need help to provide solutions, yes, the social platforms have to play a part. But where does that start? Yeah, the age of consent is one thing. Can governments and regulators and lawmakers do more in the same way they would look at vapes now or tobacco or alcohol?
Yeah, absolutely.
You must have sympathy for parents in this, that they need a little bit more help.
Absolutely. And look, you know, I was a parent, or was a parent, I am a parent.
That's good. It's
still
endured.
There.
Good.
Endured, exactly. Freudian slip there. Yeah, I am a parent. I have two, you know, kind of teenage boys. Neither were given access to a mobile phone of their own until they were 16, well, almost 16. So it was the September after the Leaving Cert, or the Junior Cert.
As a neurodevelopment therapist, is that your advice to parents? Just
absolutely.
Don't do it.
100%.
What if you've given your children the old phone? How do you get it back?
Close the door after the horse has bolted.
Yes, yeah.
Look at it, you know. And it's not, this is not to judge parents who have given children a phone, because, you know, there is a lot of, oh gosh, everybody else in the classroom has it, so, you know, I should, or it helps me stay connected with them or so on. There are alternatives that you can give that aren't like a supercomputer in their pocket that is completely unregulated. You can just get a little flip phone or something that, you know, if it's for school, moving around or whatever, those are available. And I would absolutely suggest converting to one of those rather than giving them complete unadulterated access to the supercomputer, basically. And I suppose another thing would be to remember that the important thing is that you're not teaching your children to be sheep. You're teaching them to be individual thinkers, and that they can assess a situation and figure out, is it good for me? Is it not good for me? Do I want to do this? And so on. So by, you know, submitting to that peer pressure, or the pester power, as they call it, from your child, because they're always going to be pestering, looking for something. In this instance, it's really important to really anchor in and to kind of say, look, it's not good for your brain if I give this to you now. So we're not going to do it. And actually, by being consistent, it'll take about three of those conversations using the same tone of voice, the same kind of, you know, age-appropriate language, and just explaining why you're not giving them access to their own phone. And they'll stop. They will actually stop, because they'll know, oh, look, there's no getting around them. Once you hand over that phone, you don't have the power anymore.
You've given it up.
You've given it up. And then the conversation continually is about, stop, put the phone down. you're not supposed to be using the phone between this time and this time. You know, it's a constant, can I have the phone now? I need to text a friend, or, oh, I need to just check this. Yeah. I need to do this. It's a constant. So if you think the pestering is bad to get the phone, wait until they have access to the phone. Then the pestering really begins.
Yeah, you know? Look, there's a whole other conversation about when does it move from habit to addiction. And look, I wish we could spend a bit longer about this and we might come back to it another day. But sadly, time is upon us and we'll have to leave it there.
It's a Pandora's box, all right.
Certainly is, Alwyn. But thank you for giving us those words of advice to end us off today. That was Alwyn Moran, neurodevelopment therapist and founder of Cogni Kids. Alwyn, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a million, Mandy.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, I'll speak to the author, Daniel Susskind. We'll be talking about his new book on our obsession with global growth. You're welcome back to Taking Stock. Now, for our final item today, we're going to look at the area of growth, because when we think about the economy, we invariably think about how fast or how slow it is growing. But has that always been the case? And how constant is growth in our history of economies? My next guest has just published a magnificent history of economic growth and looks at its past, but also its potential future. It's a real pleasure to welcome back to the show Daniel Susskind. Daniel, you're welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thank you so much for having me. Real pleasure to be with you.
Now, it seems such a staple of our economic discussion, growth, but actually, it's a really intriguing way to look at it. What actually made you stop and take the issue of growth and look at that very specifically?
I mean, there are very few things that all politicians agree about today, but one of them is that we need more economic growth. In the UK, worklessness and poverty are rising. Public services are backlogged and broken. Average real wages, the best measure we have of our collective prosperity, haven't really moved for about 15 years. And so there's a sense that we desperately need more growth. But if only the problem were as simple as that, because, you know, growth also appears to be responsible for many of our greatest problems, climate change, growing inequalities in society, the disruption of work and politics by new technologies like artificial intelligence, the desolation of local places and communities. And so there's this tension between the extraordinary promise of growth, that growth actually turns out to be associated with almost every measure of human flourishing, but on the other hand, the extraordinary price of growth. And so there is, sitting in the middle of our lives, our political and social lives, this growth dilemma. And resolving it just seemed to me to be one of the, you know, one of the most important issues of our time.
But it seems to me, having read some of this, that actually in our daily debate, you just take growth as a given, firstly, that it's a good thing. Yeah. And actually, when you start to consider it, you realize there's consequences of that growth. And what is the possibility of degrowth? And what would that do? And we'll come to that in a moment. But I might look back at the history, if you wouldn't mind, for a second, because in the general scheme of things, it's a relatively new phenomenon.
Extremely new. And this is what, one of the surprises, that when you look at the history of growth, you know, before the 1950s, almost no politicians, policymakers, economists, anyone was talking about the idea of economic growth. And even if people had wanted to pursue it, like we pursue it today, it wouldn't have been possible to. You know, we didn't really have a reliable measure of the size of the economy until the middle of the 1940s, a measure that would become known as GDP. So I think that's one surprise, which is, you know, quite how recent this idea of economic growth really is. Another surprise is actually how little we know about the causes of growth. Politicians and policymakers today talk very confidently about what drives growth and what causes growth. But when you look at what we actually know, you know, the causes of growth are one of, I think, the great mysteries of economics. We know far less than that sense of assuredness that we get from our political leaders.
Yeah, and the first part of the book is called Escape, and it's about that notion of freeing growth, because for such a, and you mentioned it, politicians don't even register it or start mentioning it until the 1950s, but now they've gone to the other extreme. Like, all politicians talk about is growth of some description. If it's not economic, it's housing, it's social investment, it's all about growth and growing and getting bigger.
That's right. So we've got this sort of, as I say, we've got this dilemma, which is, on the one hand, it feels like we desperately need more growth, and there are lots of puzzles about exactly what causes it. But on the other hand, our sort of relentless pursuit of growth, what some people have called a sort of obsession or even a fetish for growth, has led to a whole variety of different costs and different prices in society. You know, from, as I said before, destroying the environment to widening inequalities and you know, reconciling the promise and the price of growth, I think is immensely difficult.
And look, of course, there's huge positives to having growth as well. There's, you know, living better lives, living longer, being healthier.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Maybe it's fair. It would be fair for us to actually point out what the positives of that growth and the introduction.
And this has to be the starting point, which is that, you know, growth turns out to be associated with almost every measure of human flourishing. It's not a surprise that today we pursue it as aggressively as we do. And it's not just that, you know, growth in the 20th century has lifted, you know, literally billions of people out of extreme poverty, but exactly as you say, richer societies have better healthcare systems, richer societies have better education systems. You know, almost any measure of human flourishing that you can come up with is associated with some way with economic growth. So it's understandable that we pursue it. The problem is that it also comes with all these costs as well.
And the other thing, I suppose, is about equity and the share of that growth. Do you analyse that within the book?
That's right. Yeah. And so I think that's one of the big, you know, when people talk about the price of growth or the cost of growth, it's often put in environmental terms that we're sort of growing towards an ecological catastrophe, that climate change has become a climate emergency, and that's being driven by the pursuit of growth, and the, you know, the technologies that we use being emitting carbon dioxide and so on. But that's only one part of the story. I think these inequalities are another part, which is that although in many societies around the world growth has made us more collectively prosperous than ever before, we're also, as societies, more divided as well. Inequalities on a variety of measures around the world, economic inequalities that is, are rising. And these issues of how we share out this extraordinary prosperity that we're creating, I think, is one of the, you know, one of the great issues of our time.
Indeed. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and I'm speaking to author Daniel Susskind about his new book. It's called Growth, A Reckoning. And that's an interesting subtitle, A Reckoning, because it sort of suggests that there's soon to be a price paid or an ultimate questioning of this. And it brings us to the issue of degrowth or positive growth, because you assert that there's that potential to grow, but just grow in a better way.
Yeah. So there is a movement which called the degrowth movement, and it began among a small group of, you know, relatively obscure academics a few decades ago. And it's the idea that because of the costs of growth, we ought to not simply press pause on the economy, but even go back in reverse to pursue negative GDP growth. And what's happened in the decades since is that this has become more and more mainstream. You know, politicians like Caroline Lucas, environmentalists like David Attenborough, activists like Greta Thunberg, all appeal in different ways to this idea of degrowth, that we need to, you know, slow down or even go into reverse. And I think they get one thing right, and this is really important, which is this sense that something has to give, that we cannot go on growing in the particular way that we are. Now, they're focused on the environmental aspect often, but as I set out in the book, there are lots of other costs associated with economic growth. As we were talking about, widening inequalities, as I've written about in the past, development of new technologies like AI, which are disrupting work and politics, And then I think also these, you know, regional stories about how particular places and communities are just left behind by growth. So I think actually probably the degrowth movement underestimate the price of growth. But what I think they get wrong is their basic, you know, solution, which is to press pause on growth. So if you were to take them seriously and actually do that, I really think it would be one of the greatest acts of self-harm that humankind could really inflict on itself. Yeah, if you imagine that what they're calling for, say, is freezing global GDP per head at current levels, so you freeze everyone's incomes around the world at current levels, that would mean you'd have to condemn about 800 million people to extreme poverty forever. And if you find that unacceptable, then you're going to have to slash the incomes of the 7.1 billion people that remain. In other words, slash the incomes of most of the developed world. And it just seems to me so unimaginative to think that our current economic lot is the best that we could do, that we should press pause on growth, not just for the next 10 years or next 100 years, but for all time. And so the starting point in my book is that we need more growth, but we also need a different type of growth as well. And that's how we, in my view, solve the growth dilemma.
And I think you actually, that word extreme is very interesting in this particular debate, because to try and sell that extreme is not possible. And politicians, whatever party they're from, they're not going to really get behind those type of extreme messaging. And actually, if you look at the likes of David Attenborough, Greta Thunberg, they were very successful in highlighting the climate change issue and really getting a lot of politicians on side. But actually, when we came to the energy crisis and prices started creeping up in households and the cost of living affected everybody, you know, suddenly that as a political issue dropped down the agenda a little bit. So maybe the word they should be looking for is this transition that you mentioned as well.
I think that's right. I think they're sort of, you know, parts of their diagnosis of what's wrong with the world are spot on. And the sense of urgency that they bring is vital. But I think their solutions are not simply unhelpful, but they're actively dangerous. You know, we just don't stand a hope of achieving our most basic ambitions for society. Good healthcare for everyone, good education for everyone, you know, basic level of material comfort. If we press pause and the only engine that we have that we know about that's been able to deliver those sorts of things in the past.
I just ask you there, Daniel, because you've said a couple of times now you feel that the solution that they're offering is dangerous. Why do you think they get traction? Is it because of social media promoting negatives, or why do you think that that's so unhelpful at the moment?
I mean, I think they get traction in part. It's just in part, it's just an intuitive idea that if growth is the problem, then less growth must be the solution. I think in part there's also a deeper reason that many people find it appealing, which is you know, some of your listeners might have heard their slogan before, which is you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. And that seems quite appealing as an idea. Of course,
we've
got a finite planet.
Rational.
You know, we can't keep on growing forever. And one of the key arguments of my book is that actually that's just wrong. We can have effectively infinite growth on a finite planet. And the reason it's wrong to think otherwise is rooted in a sort of misunderstanding about how it is that economic growth actually works. Economic growth doesn't come, and this is what I think emerges from that sort of deep dive into our understanding of growth. It's very murky, it's very ambiguous, but what comes out of it is one clear lesson, which is that growth does not come from using more and more of our finite resources just endlessly. It comes from finding ever more productive ways of making use of those resources. In other words, it comes through technological progress. And what I do in the book is, you know, explain in a bit more detail why it is that that idea that we, you know, cannot keep on growing is wrong. That said, I don't think we can keep growing in the way that we are. And so that's what I then move on to in the book, to explore not simply how we can get more growth, but how we might change the nature of the growth that unfolds as well.
And I do think that comes across, that while the resources are finite, innovation and creativity isn't. Look, finally, Daniel, I'd love to talk about this a lot more, but you might just tell us who this book would appeal to.
I think it would appeal to people who are feeling, it's very, we live in an age of anxiety. At a time when every day we are reminded of the sorts of existential threats that we're facing and our supposed incapacity to deal with them. And I really, you know, it really feels this way in the UK, in Britain at the moment. And what I try and do in the book is tell an optimistic story, a story of how we actually have an existential opportunity in front of us, a chance to pay far more attention to other valuable things in society that we might have neglected until now. So I'd say for those who are wanting to feel optimistic about the future, who are wanting to try and find out how we can respond to these great challenges of our time, climate change, inequality, technologies like AI, disrupting work and politics, and, you know, and so on and so on, this is the book for them. People who are looking for an optimistic and practical guide to how we can respond to these great challenges.
We just had a discussion on the programme about a new book that's out called The Anxious Generation. And you're right, a lot of us are immersed in a bad news doom loop cycle. So I certainly, as someone who's interested in current affairs and business, I found it very enlightening. So Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today, and the very best of luck with your new book. That was Daniel Suskin, and author of a new book called Growth, A Reckoning. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thanks so much.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Now, we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings. We're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. My thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.